pin here. At unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Guru, Deity, Protector, Part 8.
I'd like to take any questions for a few moments. Do you have some notes?
No.
Okay, yeah, please.
Okay, small question. Not actually a practice question, but in the devotional prayer, page 15.
Yeah, left mine up in the bottom.
Do you have a copy of that?
Took it down and bring it up.
I gave you two.
You actually gave me three.
Lost them all.
I haven't lost them. I just left the one that was used to be here.
Okay.
Okay.
Anyway,
on page 15, the second verse from the bottom. It says, when I practice Angel's sluggish and sleepy, that I understand. And then the next sentence is, when I don't practice, my senses are clear and sharp. And I was just wondering about that, because from personal experience, when I don't practice, it's more like I'm coming off a 3-day cocaine bender.
You know what that's like.
Well, individual experience varies, of course, but many times when we sit down to practice, all those parts of us that don't want to be there come up in different ways. And one of the ways they come up is you can't focus, or you know, you're just doing it half-heartedly, and going through the motions. You aren't really clear and awake. And as soon as you stop, you know, yeah. Feel awake and alive. You never experienced that?
No.
Okay. Anybody here experienced that? Okay. One sec, though. I've got too many layers on. Okay, yes.
Can you explain what it means to magnetize? A little more clearly, I don't understand that.
You're kidding. What was the last play you produced?
When was it?
What was the last one?
A play called Vagrant.
Pardon?
It was a play a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, okay. Any of the actors ever step out of line?
Do you mean during the performance?
No, I mean while you were being directed.
Yeah.
Director? You tried talking with him, didn't do any good. Tried cajoling or bribing them. Did you get them to do what you wanted?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you do it?
Insistence.
A little more than insistence, wasn't it?
Yeah, okay.
Let's back with that.
Okay.
I'll talk about this anymore.
I think refuge in mind itself enters the music of the mind itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that chitta?
Actually, it'd be chittata. Chittata, yeah. Well, the mind itself is so neat. Yeah. There are different ways of approaching this, but the isness of mind.
And by mind, that means mind and heart.
Yeah, in Buddhism, mind is used in different ways. Citta, in Tibetan Zen, it's used in different ways. But in this context, it's used for all mental and emotional activity. So it's all of that stuff.
Including perceptions.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. And Gunther argued reasonably that mind in this context could be translated as experience or experiencing. Okay. What is the isness of experience?
It's how you experience it, or what experience it
is. Yeah. Okay. What is that? Empty, luminous, pure being. Okay. Now, that's the ultimate refuge.
The what?
The ultimate refuge. If you put it in terms of the three marks of existence, there is nothing that changes because there's nothing there. It's empty. Suffering doesn't arise because there's no reaction. And there's no sense of being anything. With me? Okay? Any questions? Okay.
Is it the short Vajrayana?
Mm-hmm.
It's always, my literal mind doesn't get this. It keeps saying, to this meditator who does not yearn for comfort and wealth and has severed ties to this life. Well, if this meditator was referring to me, I do yearn for comfort and wealth, still.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I do. And then it says, give me the energy to stop longing for money and prestige, which sort of presupposes that they're figuring that you already do that. I just don't get why that it says there that you don't yearn and then gives you the energy to stop yearning.
Okay. So you start practice and you say, oh, it's just about being present, getting rich, getting famous, that doesn't mean anything. Just work at being present. You sever, you cut through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long does that last?
Not too long. Just keep doing it,
you mean? Okay. Yeah. They're very realistic.
Yeah. So it's about the going back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I don't yearn for comfort and wealth. I've severed the ties to this life. But it keeps coming back, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So give me the energy to stop longing It's pretty. Yeah, this is the direction I'm going, but the claws keep coming up, they keep grabbing. And can grab in many, many different ways. And there are many my colleagues, other teachers that I know of, they've been seduced in various ways. And you know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. It's true.
The price of freedom is eternal
vigilance. I think it was that Roosevelt said that. Pardon? Mm-hmm.
Or Emerson?
Well, I don't think Emerson would have got that far.
Woodsworth. Plato.
No, I think it's one of the presidents.
Kennedy.
Pardon?
Kennedy.
Oh, no, it was before Kennedy, definitely. He may have quoted it, but definitely from that.
Is it Settle on Roosevelt?
No, for the time being. I'll look it up on Google. Google's very good that way. Just type in a quote, it goes right there. One of the impressions that you get from most Buddhist traditions, but particularly the Tibetan, I think more so than the others, is that you get to a point where things just take care of themselves. I've not seen any evidence for that. Jonathan Contrell, who authored this long prayer, quite an extraordinary person, and his autobiography has been translated into English, you can get it. And it's a typical Tibetan autobiography with long lists of requirements and teachers and ceremonies that he did, and things like that, but interspersed in all of this stuff you get a feeling for the person. I think he lived to 89 or so. He was born at the beginning of the 19th century, I think 1812, died at the end of it. And very shortly before his death, he says, I'm quite concerned about dying now. And don't forget, this is one of the great lamas of the 19th century. My mind's very clouded and confused. A couple of years ago, my mind was really clear. And if I died then, I think I would have been okay. But I'm really not sure what's going to happen now. And I read this in retreat, and I was like,
was it discouraging?
Well, yes and no. it shattered the illusion for me. And for this I'm quite grateful. And you can say this was discouraging if you wish. That you get to a point and everything's hunky-dory. And on the other hand, I was left with the appreciation. It doesn't matter how far you get or what you get to. You still have to meet the next experience. Aduchiyama in Refining Your Life makes the same point in a very, very different way. He describes this experience he had when a cut on his foot became infected and he got blood poisoning. And he was in excruciating pain and horrible fever. And unable to go to a doctor because he was very unusual as a Japanese monk. He actually earned his living from begging in the 50s, which was like hadn't been done for about a century. Took Dharma somewhat seriously. And so he couldn't possibly go to a doctor, he didn't have the money. And a woman who lived in the neighborhood eventually gave him some licorice bulbs, which he packed around the cut in his foot and drew the poison out. And so he got better. But then he writes, I would only be fooling myself if I thought that getting through that experience would be any help if I were to encounter a similar intensity of pain and suffering again. And you can hear things like this and you can wonder, well, what are we doing all this for? It doesn't help. Well, it does, but not in the ways that we usually hope it will. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No.
I think, well, I'll just speak for me. I don't know about any of you. I have my suspicions. There's always this secret part of us that goes, you know, if I do this, everything's going to turn out okay. And, you know, life will go well. I'll be happy. I won't have any more problems. You know, there's part of us, I think, that always hopes, is hoping for that. And then we find ourselves in some kind of crisis or really unpleasant situation. Maybe our spouse quite unexpectedly breaks up with us. Someone close to us is dying and very painfully, or we get very ill. I mean, these things happen. And everything is up. You know, all our hopes and our disappointments and our fears, and it's all there. But we've trained. And because we've trained, and we've come to some kind of understanding, while it's very, very vivid, something in us knows that the only thing to do here is experience it. And so we do. We don't fight experience. We may not enjoy it, but we don't fight it. It's there. Whether we're insane or depressed or frightened, those are the easier ones to work with. When we're being admired, loved, you know, center of attention, those are the more difficult ones to make. But it's all just an experience. And we still have to do things. Take care of this person who's ill. Work through the challenges of the situation in which we're terrified. Put our life back together when our spouse leaves us, or a child dies, or something like that. We still have to do it all. But there's a knowing, I think, in which we know that it's okay, whatever it is, it's okay, that's just that.
Well, sort of along those lines, I was wondering if you would give a little bit more commentary on the points raised in the first part of that, sort of premise for how I would practice, specifically how one comes to see reactivity as a luminous mind.
That's the easy part.
That's the easy part?
Yeah.
What's the hard part?
Well, maybe just me.
And also, what of these practices you've given, what was the best one to do?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that today,
this afternoon.
Pardon?
Before that? Based on what you said, I mean, did you make it sound cleaner than it really is? In that, if we have an effective practice, we perhaps go less insane than the person who doesn't, or go insane for a shorter period of time, or.
That's about right.
Okay.
That was a good idea.
Ken, that's not true.
that's not accurate.
Okay. What do you have to say?
Well, I think you could go just as insane, but you would be more aware. I mean, I'm entirely serious.
Yeah,
I
know, I know what you mean. But I think
Dara prayer suggests that, for example, that at the same time that you know that you aren't performing the practice, you are aware of what your yearning is.
And what is the consequence of your being aware that you're completely insane?
Then there isn't harm that comes from the activity.
Yeah, and I think that's what April was pointing to.
Yeah. But I don't think you can think that it's not going to happen that hard to you. I think that's a mistake.
I agree with that. Yeah, that was much
smarter. Certainly, that was a mistake I made.
Okay. Chris?
You just said the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes up. But there's that knowing there. And.
But you think that knowing is going to protect you?
No, but no, it doesn't.
It helps with the despair, I think. It helps avoid.
No.
This is what I meant earlier when I said.
Yes.
No, because you see, when you experience despair, you have to experience fully. You don't need any rationalization to make it less or better, right?
Has anybody got a coin here? You know, because you're talking about heads and tails, but you're actually talking about the same coin. Okay. And Josephine and Chris are looking at one side and say, it's heads. And Abel's going, no, it's tails.
Happen to have both kind of distinction.
But the, well, you have your experience, don't you? Right. That's it. You have your experience. This is what makes different schools of Buddhism.
Of old Dasanya as well. I mean, that when you're in that place, even if people that you practice with aren't right there with you, you have that energy, I think, that assists you when you're in that place.
One can draw on that. But it's the energy ultimately is your own mind.
It occurs to me that rather than looking at it as a shorter period of grieving or less intense grieving or less despair, that you might look at it as not generating as much karma of the activity later on because it's experienced fully in the moment.
This is what Josephine was saying. That's right.
It also makes it more interesting.
Yes, I've said that to a few students. But I only when there are no sharp objects.
The other thing is it makes it much faster.
Not always. And the reason, and
generally.
In the sense that because you're not resisting experience, things can unfold. But there isn't anything intrinsic in that, which means it's going to take place more quickly. There are things that just take whatever time it is to unfold. And being enlightened doesn't necessarily speed that process up. Being awake in the experience doesn't necessarily speed that process up. And so, you know, I understand where Chris and Josephine are coming, because in one hand, all it does is reduce reactivity. It can be just as intense and insane. On the other hand, because you're not resisting experience, then one may not be prolonging the process, and that gives these senses to move faster.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. So, as I say, heads and tails, you're talking about the same point.
Or never underestimate the resistance.
Very wise point. Yes. Now, which one is the eight concerns dissolved like a rainbow, the placements of reactive emotions? That, which line you wanted, Dan?
Yeah, that goes sort of first there. When everything arises through the gates of the sixth century of consciousness, I know that everything good or bad is a friend of the mind. Or the concerns dissolve like a rainbow, the poisons of reactive emotions become a friend. Thinking of attachment to reactive emotions or those poisons of
reactive. Well, let's take desire. Okay. So, pick someone or something that elicits desire in you. And for the purposes of this exercise, the stronger the better. And it can be any form of desire. Desire for praise, desire for recognition, sexual desire, desire for affection, desire for a particular possession, object. And think of the object and let your desire come up. Don't put any restrictions on it. Really feel it. Now, move into the experience of desire itself. Don't protect yourself from it in any way whatsoever. How does it arise in your body? In addition to the desire, what are all the emotions connected with? Longing, resentment, all kinds of things. Unworthiness, intimidation. Entitlement, all of it. And all of the stories in your head about this person or object of your desire and about desire itself. So it's all there. Take pleasure in feeling this intensity of desire. What do you experience? Now, look at the object again. What do you feel for the object?
Not there.
Well, bring the object to mind. Look at it. What do you feel for the object?
Nothing in
particular. Anybody else? Anybody else?
Is it connection?
Yeah. But it's not a connection based on trying to own the desire.
No.
So that's the transfer.
It's equanimity.
Yeah, it's a bit more than equanimity. Appreciation. You know everything about it now. You can see it actually more clearly. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's discriminating, Christina wants.
Mm-hmm.
inspiring.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Fire on.
To transform the fire. Yeah. That's what it means. When it says the poisons of reactive emotions become acute. By experiencing them completely. And that kind of transformation takes place with every reactive emotion. Or every emotional reaction, I should change that. Now, the eight concerns dissolve like a rainbow. Well, the eight concerns. Happiness, unhappiness, gain, loss, fame, obscurity, respect, and disdain. I will do this a different way. Become your yidda. Whether it's the embodiment of awakened compassion, awakened anger, that you're totally awake in this quality. You are this quality, totally awake. You know, like awakened pride, total equanimity. Awakened jealous. And you see exactly what needs to be done and you just do it. Okay. In that, how concerned are you with happiness and unhappiness? Hmm?
Not really.
But they arise, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like the mist in the morning or rain. Gain and loss. You inherit $1 million and the taxman taketh away.
Lots.
Pardon?
Lots.
All of it. What is it to you as when you're awake and present to the other? Well, we have this illusion that, you know, we own a house or a car or something. It's not true. All we're doing is we're paying somebody somewhere something for the use of it for a period of time. Even our closest relationships are just experiences. They come, they go. Fame, obscurity. What are these to you as the yidam? Pardon? Yeah. What they are actually is other people's ideas about you. Not about you at all. They're other people's ideas about you. Respect and disdain.
Same thing.
Mm-hmm. And so, with that knowing, you can meet what arises and experience, not ignoring these things, because they arise just part of the experience, but they aren't any hooks anymore. we don't try to avoid one or plunge after the other. Okay? Did that give you enough idea of this?
Yeah. And the transformative quality of the energy of those things becomes pristine awareness.
We never transform anything.
I'm not saying we do.
Yeah, I know. But I'm playing safe here.
Okay.
We don't transform anything. When we experience things as they are, transformation takes place. But we don't transform anything.
What is this now?
But it happens. And all of you have experienced it. Okay. Well, I was going to talk about something else this morning, but this is good. So I'm going to...
Ken, there was a question. Is that all right?
Sorry.
I'm struck by the similarity between what we're working on here and taking this thing, and what you just said reminds me again, partly that they're both tools that we can learn to apply to reactions that we notice coming up. Do you have anything to say yes or no about
well. As Conchal says at the beginning of the Great Path of Awakening, taking and sending has its feet firmly in the Sutrayana, but partakes of the Vajrayana. And it's a wonderful bridge, actually. In essence, all practice of attention transforms experience. Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. And it doesn't really matter what you practice when you know how to practice. I had a rather dismaying conversation with an old friend who has practiced many, many years in the Theravada tradition. He's very bright, very knowledgeable. And for the last few years, he's been doing a lot of work in Dzogchen. And he says he's just stunned at the differences between these two approaches.
What was the other approach?
Dzogchen.
Mm-hmm.
And says they're totally different. That's very interesting. The more I practice, the more similar they seem to be. No. What do you see as the differences? And says, well, the spiritual ideal. One is this monk withdrawn from the world. The other is this Mahasiddha who engages all experience. So I didn't push it any further. Don't be fooled by the forms. Shanti Deva, the author of the Bodhicharyavatara, was a monk in a monastery, and everybody thought that he was a bit dim, because he just showed up for meals and ceremonies, you know, regular prayer services in the temple. Nobody saw him doing much study or anything like that. He didn't seem to have much to say about anything. And in this monastery there is a annual festival which was sponsored by a major patron of the monastery, one of the local kings. And it was the custom that one of the monks delivered a discourse. So the monks, the monastery decided to have some fun. And they thought they'd have Shanti Deva deliver the discourse, being kind of dim idiot. It made for an entertaining time to see what he came up with. So they approached him and said, "Would you be open to this?" And he said, "Okay." So put him up on a big throne, things like that, and all the monks and all the patrons, everybody's gathered around, and all the monks are like, and Shanti Deva just sat, looked at everybody and said, "Would you like to hear a discourse on something traditional text, or would you like to hear something new?" And there were smirks and snickers and things like that. So, "Oh, why don't you say something new?" And he started into the Bodhicharyavatara.
He started into what?
To the Bodhicharyavatara, entering the way of the Bodhisattva, this great epic poem about Bodhicitta.
Oh. Didn't he rise off the ground?
Yeah, the 10th chapter, he rises up into the air and disappears.
That's good.
That's a good ending.
He knew how to make an exit. This is internal work. It's not about outer forms. It's internal work. And this is what is one of the things I wanted to talk about this morning. All of you have been exposed, practiced actually, a number of different practices. And in our time here together, I've introduced you to, as best I can, to the experience of guru practice, the experience of yidam practice, and the experience of protectors and dakinis. Now, all of you, most of you, already, even with a short exposure, feel some connection in some areas and realize that there isn't connection in other areas. And that's how it is. The reason there are a multiplicity of practices is because there are a multiplicity of emotional reactions and combinations thereof. And certain approaches untie knots for one person, and other approaches untie knots for another. In the three-year retreat, in the second three-year retreat, the retreat director, Ramathemba, I've spoken about before. When we got to the section on the four measurables in taking and sending, he told everybody to do another practice. It was the special shamatan insight Rinpoche taught. I felt terribly sad about this, really sad, because the practice of the four immeasurables and taking and sending had been a really very important part of my experience in the first 3 year retreat, and made a very deep difference for me. And like a true bodhisattva, I took Lama Tenpa to task on this and got quite angry with him. He said, you cheated these people out of this experience. This good practice, but they really need this, etc. Quite worked up about it. And eventually he just looked at me and said, well, those practices worked for you, Ken. They never worked for me. And it's true, he didn't do those at all. His primary practice was Mahamudra. And that's why he was teaching and having people do this, because he wanted people to get into the direct experience of mind. Because that's what he found. That's what he found. So there are these differences. It's one of the reasons why I don't feel at all comfortable with trying to give you all the same Vajrayana practice and, you know, do it all together. There's just too much individual variation at this level of practice. So, in the time we have, and also after the retreat, but right now, what I want you to do is to focus on the guru practice or the yidam practice, which speaks to you most powerfully. Within the framework of guru practice, there is the faith of confidence, faith of longing, and the faith of clear open appreciation. These are very intertwined, but in my conversations with you, I also know that some of you feel more resonance with one expression of faith than another, in many cases. And so you mine it. In the faith of longing, you follow the longing. You don't try to put an end to it, you follow it. And let it take you deep and deep and deep into your own heart. Because as it takes you deep into your own heart, it takes you deep into the heart of the teacher and the guru. It takes you deep into the heart of Buddha. Clear open appreciation, you fall, and you fall, and you fall, and you fall. With confidence, there's always that next step, and then the next one. And in those practices, you can't help but engage your emotional material. It's there. It rises in many, many different ways. In clear open appreciation, it's almost like discovering depths of feeling of an openness and an absence of self you didn't know was possible. In longing, it's you didn't know you could feel anything, any longing that deeply, so forth. And by experiencing this completely, the energy of all of that emotion is transformed into attention and opens awareness. And that's one of the essential methods of the Vajrayana. In the Theravadin tradition, one uses loving kindness to transform experience into attention and power attention. In the Mahayana path, we use compassion. That's what bodhicitta is about. In Vajrayana, it's faith and devotion. If, as is the case for some of you, your resonance is more with the yidam, then you be the yidam 100%. Let him or her take you over completely. If you're working with a trait in you, as if some people are, you experience that trait with all the stuff connected with it. So it's a feeling of superiority. You don't hold back. You're the ruler of the whole universe. Everybody without any exception bows down to you. And you go into that completely. If you're using an ideal like compassion, you are compassion. Every cell of your skin, of your body, every corpuscle in your blood, every beat of your heart, every breath you take, every morsel you eat, is the expression of compassion. And if you take a reactive emotion, anger, jealousy, then you are that through and through. Greed, you take everything in the world. Everything. Everything is yours. Nothing. It's all yours. And you relate to the world from that perspective. See what happens. So that's how I want you to work. And discuss, of course, any of the questions or experiences that you have in the interviews. If you run into something that is intractable, invoke protectors if you wish. But you just do that occasionally. You know, most of you have experience of that now, so you don't need to do it a lot. I also want to say a few words about afternoon practice. I probably should have been a bit more precise. When I said do nothing, I didn't mean do nothing. I meant do nothing. Is that clear? Long Chenpo lived 13th, 14th century. Spent 12 years in a cave not too far from Lhasa. He wrote some of the Seven Treasuries while there. But most of the time, he did nothing. Now, I want you to take this in. In the afternoon period, you go and sit somewhere. And do nothing. And in a relatively short time, you may find some voices inside you saying, this isn't very productive. What's the point of this? I should be working at something. This isn't helping. Any of you know these voices? Well, you've been sitting there for 5 minutes. How shrill would the voices become if you sat there for the whole day? A week, a month, or 12 years.
Wouldn't they get used to it?
Wouldn't you get used to it? I don't know whether you would or not. Most people don't. The voices eventually take over and they get up and start doing something. That's been the historical fact. Those individuals who actually can let those voices talk, scream, rage, and continue to do nothing. Be no one. Not try to get any emotional need met. Not be the least concerned with their survival. They're actually pretty rare individuals. So, that's what I want you to do in the afternoon. Deborah.
Do you consider that noticing sounds, smells, feelings, sights is doing something?
As long as you don't do anything with them.
Okay, then she's clear.
Claudia?
Question.
Claudia, first.
Uh-huh. I have a practical question.
Yes.
Related to protectors.
Yes.
It is my experience that not only do we not control what or how the work is done, but when it is done. And so, especially in this kind of an environment, that work continues, whether we want it to or not.
Yes? Don't forget. When you are, everything falls apart inside you, and you're experiencing total chaos and confusion, and you're convinced that you cannot endure one more second of this, you're experiencing exactly what you came here to do. So be great. And give yourself a pat on the back. Your efforts have been effective. Congratulations. Doesn't feel like it at the time, I know. But your purpose in coming here was to be awake, to wake up, right? What prevents us from being awake? The habituated patterns that are formed around experiences that we have not been able to experience in attention. When all of that's happening, you're experiencing one of those. That's what you came here to do. Deborah. Last one.
Because I found working with the protector quite intense, what happened to me was all of the holdouts that I don't want practice to change with the living present.
Can't quite hear you.
They came vividly present in the fear.
All of the holdouts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I want to understand if offering all the richness of the world can be done not like a normal offering, but by knowing that everything that I attach to is what I think is the richness of the world. And that's rare.
Say that again, please.
Everything I want, everything I hold on to, everything I get attached to, I believe, I think of as the richness of the world. So, in being aware that that is true, am I making that offering to the protector? In going to my fears, my deepest fears about what I don't want to lose, and therefore want to protect from the present, protect from changing. Am I in the journal realm? Am I actually offering your instruction? And is that in the contemplative state?
You have this yearning. Experienced and complete. You have these fears. Experienced and complete. Don't form any ideas about what you may or may not be doing. Just do it. You understand. Okay. We'll close here. Interesting.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.